Cardiomyopathies are a heterogeneous group of disorders, and different classifications have been proposed. And based on the ESC classification, what we use in Germany, these disorders can be categorized into 5 different categories: arrhythmogenic, dilated, hypertrophic, restrictive, and unclassified cardiomyopathies. Dilated cardiomyopathy is defined as a dilated left ventricle and decrease in systolic function of the left ventricle. The mechanism or the cause of these disorders can be genetic or non-genetic, and it's typical for hypertrophic cardiomyopathy and arrhythmogenic cardiomyopathy that they have a primarily genetic basis. This is not true for dilated cardiomyopathy. Familial disease is found or can be found in 20 to 30% of the cases. Interesting is that patients with the familial disease, dilated cardiomyopathy based on genetic defects, usually present at a relatively young age. I will come back to this later in my talk. The slide shows a list of genes that have been found to be responsible for these disorders, and this figure comes from a publication from 2008. The lists have become much longer today, or up to date, more than 30 genes that may cause hypertrophic cardiomyopathy have been identified, and the number of genes that may cause dilated cardiomyopathy has to increase to more than 50 different genes that may be responsible for the disease. The causative or the acquired causes are listed here on the right-hand side. You can see that many causes may lead to dilated cardiomyopathy. And it's a pity, and I will also come back to this, that in all the studies we have, usually the outcome of the patients is not based on distinguishing the causes for the disease, but all the patients with dilated cardiomyopathy are put under one umbrella. And what we generally do is we talk about dilated cardiomyopathy, and we believe that this is a relatively homogeneous disease, but this is not the case. This is data coming from the pre-ICD era, so a long time ago, and what the thing on the left-hand side shows, survival in these patients, particularly bad in patients with dilated cardiomyopathy, even worse in patients with hypertrophic and arrhythmogenic cardiomyopathy. And on the right-hand side, you can see the contribution of sudden cardiac death to overall mortality in these patients, again, in the pre-ICD era, and the amount of patients dying suddenly was particularly high in hypertrophic cardiomyopathy and arrhythmogenic cardiomyopathy. But even in dilated cardiomyopathy, the older data show that 1/5 of the patients dies suddenly or died suddenly at that time. So the prognosis of patients with dilated cardiomyopathy has improved. This is data coming from Japan. The CHART studies were studies that included patients with heart failure and followed these patients. More than 10,000 patients were included during 2 time periods. CHART 1 was performed between 2000 and 2005, and CHART 2 between 2006 and 2014. And in a separate analysis, data on patients with dilated cardiomyopathy were presented. And the number of patients you can see here were about 300 patients in the early time period in CHART 1 and 700 patients in the later period from 2006 to 2014. And the data show that, again, prognosis significantly improved. This is various causes for dying, for death. Heart failure, the incidence of death due to heart failure decreased. And what you can see is that also the incidence of sudden cardiac death markedly decreased. So sudden cardiac death was 5.4% or 2% in the early study period, and it went down to 0.4% in the later period. So a marked decrease in the incidence of sudden cardiac death. The number of non-cardiovascular deaths increased during that time. And the authors from this publication, they followed or concluded that long-term prognosis of dilated cardiomyopathy patients has been improved along with the implantation of evidence-based medication in Japan. And recent studies show that even the usefulness of the defibrillator has decreased or suggests this. And you know which study I am meaning? It's a Danish trial, which was published a couple of years ago, which compared usual clinical care with drugs and CRT and the ICD in patients with non-ischemic systolic heart failure. More than 1,000 patients have been included, and you know all the results. There was a significant decrease in the incidence of sudden cardiac death when both groups were compared, the control group and the ICD group. but this did not lead to a decrease in the incidence of cardiac death or death from any cause. And that was a big surprise for all of us, suggesting that the ICD is not as useful as we have believed for many years. But I already touched this. My problem with all these studies is that they just talk about dilated cardiomyopathy, and they do not separate the patients depending on the cause of the disease. And it's a major fault of all these studies, and even Danish does not do this. And for me, it's important, and particularly important, that they, for example, do not distinguish between acquired and inherited forms of the disease. What we know today is that there is a difference in prognosis between patients with acquired and inherited dilated cardiomyopathy. And the problem is that we only have a paucity of data showing this. So the number of studies really addressing the cause of the disease dilated cardiomyopathy and then looking for the outcome of these patients is really low. What we have is a report from families, from small patient cohorts, and I have one publication, which is one of the largest we have. It's a publication which included 122 patients with dilated cardiomyopathy, and all these patients had an inherited form of dilated cardiomyopathy, and all patients had lamin A mutations. So a mutation, the lamin A gene, and the protein encoded by this gene encodes for the nuclear membrane of cells. So it's really important, the protein, for the integrity of the nucleus. And this is a study where 122 patients were collected from referral centers, and a retrospective analysis was performed, and then the patients were followed up for 7 years. And please note, this relatively healthy patient population at the beginning of the study, so mean age was 40, left ventricular function, ejection fraction at the time of first clinical contact was 50. So patients with preserved left ventricular function, and most patients had an ejection fraction above 50%. So everybody would suspect or expect a very low rate of events in this patient population, take into account that we have learned in recent years that dilated cardiomyopathy is a relatively benign condition. But this is the results, and the results have to be descriptive because this was not really a prospective study, not a randomized study. Data were collected, and this shows the distribution of implantable devices at the time of presentation of the patient and during follow-up. But what we can see is that some patients had a pacemaker. It's typical for this particular form of dilated cardiomyopathy that patients present with conduction disturbances. Dilated cardiomyopathy is usually not recognized, and those patients, they receive a pacemaker. But there were already, at the time of collection of the patients, some patients that had an ICD. But at the end of the study, what you can see is that the number of patients with ICD and CRT had markedly increased. So more than 70% of these patients had such a device. And the next slide summarizes what happened during the follow-up of 7 years in this particular patient population. So almost 50% of these patients who were healthy at the time of inclusion, mean ejection fraction more than 50%, developed a sustained ventricular arrhythmia during this follow-up. 22 patients experienced electrical storm, so frequent arrhythmias within a short period of time. One half of the patients received an ICD for primary prevention. 50% of these patients who received an ICD for primary prevention had ICD interventions, not inadequate shocks, but adequate shocks. 60% of the patients had CRT implantation, and of these patients who underwent CRT implantation, almost 50% had heart transplantation during a follow-up of 7 years. More than 50% of the patients had a progression to end-stage heart failure, and every sixth patient died. So what we have here is a very sick patient population, and as I see it, such patients have to be identified, and these patients have to be treated in a very special way. And this publication and other publications that result in a lot of discussion about the usefulness of CRTD and CRTP in this particular patient population, in front of the background that we currently believe, or some people believe, that we don't need CRTD devices, just CRTP may be sufficient, but not in these patients with the special types of dilated cardiomyopathy. And it was one of the conclusions of this review that when we talk about the question was better CETD or CETP in this patient, in patients with inherited forms of cardiomyopathy, CETD should be implanted and there is no role for CETP. When going through the Danish data, there are some indication for the fact that even in this study, some patients may have had inherited dilated cardiomyopathy. So again, in this study, nobody was asking whether there was an inherited disease or not, and only 75% of the patients had what they called idiopathic dilated cardiomyopathy. But the fact that the patient group in this subgroup analysis, the younger patients showed significant benefit from the ICD is comparable or compatible with that, what I just discussed, that patients with dilated cardiomyopathy, with inherited and familial dilated cardiomyopathy, they present at a relatively early age. They present at a mean age of 40 to 50. And in this patient, or in this subgroup analysis from Danish, there was a significant benefit of younger patients. I believe that a significant proportion of these patients had familial dilated cardiomyopathy, but we don't have the data. The second last slide shows or summarizes the main problem we have. It's the problem that the diagnosis of familial dilated cardiomyopathy is often overlooked. Again, we have these patients with dilated cardiomyopathy and everything is put under the same umbrella. And the diagnosis and the fact that these patients have familial disease is often overlooked. This is a study coming from the UK. It includes 30 or 73 patients who were on the waiting list for heart transplantation. And all these patients should have been seen by a cardiologist, by an experienced cardiologist. And when they were put on the waiting list, 3 out of 73 patients were diagnosed as having familial dilated cardiomyopathy. All these patients were re-evaluated, again, by cardiologists, knowing what familial heart disease is. And what came out is that after re-evaluation, 26%, which means every 4th patients were found or had a familial form of dilated cardiomyopathy. So all the other cases were missed during the initial evaluation. And the conclusion of this study is that we need to have a very close look on these patients, and the dilated cardiomyopathy needs to be categorized depending on the cause of the disease. I'm at the end of my course, so what I would like to state is that dilated cardiomyopathy is a heterogeneous group of acquired or inherited myocardial diseases, and heart failure as well as malignant arrhythmias represent a major cause of death. And this is particularly true for patients presenting, a subgroup of patients and those presenting with familial disease. And what we urgently need is prospective studies taking the specific pathological genetic substrate into consideration. We don't have any study that has randomized the ICD in patients with familial dilated cardiomyopathy. We have these studies, large studies, but where no separation is made based on the course of the disease. And the final statement, I think, is extremely important. We always talk about artificial intelligence and about personalized medicine. And even in heart failure and arrhythmias, it's time for precision medicine and precision trials. We have to take into account the individual causes of the disease in order to get conclusions what to do in these very special circumstances. Thank you very much.
Excellent talk. Thank you very much, madam. Are there any questions from the audience? Karl-Heinz? Ja, Herr Kuck? Einmal bitte das Mikro.
Herr Wagamp, vielen Dank. Ich wollte nur noch mal darauf hinweisen, dass es nie Evidenz dafür gegeben hat, dass Patienten mit dilatativer Kardiomyopathie von einem ICD profitieren. Außer dass Meta-Analysen das gezeigt haben. Wir wissen, wenn natürlich die Studie primär schlecht ist, dann ist auch die Meta-Analyse schlecht. Also das Cut-Heft, 50% hatten dilative Kardiomyopathie, kein Benefit. Definite, kein Benefit. Cut, was Herr Bench publiziert hat, kein Benefit. Es hat nie Benefit gegeben. Deswegen war ich immer überrascht, dass es, und ich habe das auch immer kritisiert, in allen Guidelines immer eine Klasse 1 Indikation war, weil es einfach gepoolt worden ist zwischen ischämischer Kardiomyopathie und dilatativer Kardiomyopathie. Ich gebe Ihnen aber recht, natürlich in diesem Punkt, den Sie erwähnen, da muss man bedenken, dass die Laminopathien natürlich eine Krankheit ist, die in den 80er Jahren, als all diese Sekundärstudien natürlich durchgeführt worden sind, überhaupt keiner kannte, weil Schweigen beachtet hat. Die Frage ist ja, welche Studie müsste man denn heute, wenn man den Oberbegriff der dilatativen Kardiomyopathie oder der nicht, besser ist es wahrscheinlich, den Ausschluss zu machen, der nicht ischämischen Kardiomyopathie zu nehmen. Wie würden Sie denn eine ICD-Studie heute konzipieren, um sicherzugehen, dass die Patienten, die möglicherweise ja ein Risiko haben, auch eingeschlossen werden? Wobei man ja einschränkend sagen muss, die familiären Kardiomyopathien sind ja prozentual natürlich ein kleiner Teil von den Patienten, die mit reduzierter nicht-ischämischer Kardiomyopathie auffallen. Also mit anderen Worten, welche Diagnostik würden Sie sich wünschen für einen nicht-ischämischen Kardiomyopathie-Trial? Mit welchem Ziel, um eine ICD-Studie heute, 20 Jahre oder 30 Jahre, sind wir ja schon fast hinter den sekundären ICD-Studien, die wir damals alle gemeinsam gemacht haben?
So the question that Dr. Cook raised was, the comment,
the comment was that, that's
we,
okay.
that we don't have,
I lost English,
that we don't have any evidence for that ICD is helpful in patients with dilated cardiomyopathy, and even the very old studies do not really help. And the question was how to proceed with new trials. We have to do it in that way the oncologists do it. They have small patient populations, yeah. And they have a detailed analysis of the characteristics of, the, of all these patients. And so what we need is, we need a detailed family history, we need genetics and all the stuff, and then we can create small patients groups, even though it may not be possible to do always randomized studies. We have to learn from these very detailed and especially characterized, carefully characterized patient groups, what is the prognosis, and when we, then we have to make decisions. So I don't know whether these small groups are really good groups for randomized trials. That may be difficult. But as seen, even though this group of patients with laminopathy, what they did is they collected the severe cases. And if you go into the families, you will have thousands of patients and the number of events will decrease. But we have to learn how to proceed in these patients when we have to learn what we have to do with these patients. And I think diagnosis is the first step. So what we need is heart failure and arrhythmias is the one thing, but we need the details. And that is personal medicine, and that is what we need in the future. And that will be discussed in the later talks, I think. And I believe that it's not sufficient to talk about arrhythmia, sudden death, and heart failure, but we need the etiology and the details.
And we need to pool data. Yeah, it's very important to have the logistics.
Yeah. As I said, the oncologists, they do it. They are able to perform what we are not able. So they pool the data all over the world. They collect the data of this very special patients group and draw their conclusions. And that is what we have to learn, I think.
To learn, right. Stefan.
Just to add one question, I mean, what you said just, Burkhard, then we need a register system for all these diseases. Now, my question was, do you think it's reasonable to do more biopsies in all these patients with non-ischemic cardiomyopathy in this group to get a better differentiation of the tissue and to make maybe new subclinical or subclassical classification?
Since I'm getting older, I like the non-invasive technique. So I love the imaging. I love the genetic analysis. And it's not doing the biopsies. Biopsy is a very difficult area. You have many, many cases where you have some infection. And it's then called borderline myocarditis. And no genetic analysis is performed. And particularly in the group of patients with this borderline myocarditis, there's a large percentage of patients with familial disease. But nobody is looking for the genetics because I believe that borderline myocarditis is the explanation for the dilated cardiomyopathy. So as I see it, it should be based on non-invasive techniques, and the costs are enormous, but that should be solvable.
Yeah. There was please. Some more?
Yeah. Thanks for your nice talk. The majority of sudden cardiac death risk is presenting in patients who have left ventricular ejection fraction more than 35%. And the majority of people who have less than left ventricular ejection fraction than 35% die anyways from heart failure. The major question is what to do with the first category of patients. And I didn't understand the German language of the previous reviewer, but I suspect I have the same question. For the left ventricular ejection fraction population with less than 35% in dilated cardiomyopathy population, we have guidelines that suggest the implantation of defibrillator based on meta-analysis. Is that right? And what is the role of non-invasive risk factors such as electrocardiographic predictors and programmed ventricular stimulation? Thank you.
So to make it short, I don't like this 35% threshold. I hate it. It makes no sense. It comes from the early studies and was the inclusion criterion of the studies. And what we need is a better risk verification. And we have already talked about the methods which are available, for example, LGE and QRS duration and all the stuff. So we need a better risk verification in order to identify those who are at a risk to die suddenly at increased risk. Not those who have an ejection fraction of 20 or 15 or so, they usually do well, but we need the younger ones who die suddenly, where the percentage of patients dying suddenly is much higher than the percentage of patients dying due to heart failure.
Thomas.
One short practical question. So you indicated that it may be very cost-intensive to do all these screening methods. So which population group would you focus on? Would you focus on the rather young patients, below 40, below 50, or do you say there is no need in focusing on any specific subgroup?
There is some need on focusing, and it's particularly what you said, the young patient, where we don't have any signs for myocarditis. So what we need is the young patient, and what we have to do is the family history. And that is what is needed, and it's usually not done. So most cardiologists do not do family history.
Okay. Thank you very much. We proceed. Thank you, Dr. Haverkamp.